Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Over the last couple of days, I have really enjoyed getting to know an important man in Wisconsin history, who I'm sorry to say I really knew nothing about until I took in hand a fascinating book called Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham, Early Chronicler of Plants, Rocks, Rivers, Mounds, and All Things Wisconsin. What a great name, Increase Lapham. And this talented, inquisitive Quaker actually ends up being responsible for what amounts to the very first book to be published in the territory of Wisconsin. And he is among the first to settle in what would eventually become the great city of Milwaukee. But his many talents and interests particularly included a number of different areas of the sciences. And Increase Lapham was someone who, even as a young teenager, was tirelessly chronicling that which he observed around him in terms of geological formations or the plants or the wildlife. He was a man who had sort of an endless reservoir of intellectual curiosity, despite the fact that he had relatively modest schooling. And so he is indeed a perfect subject for a book like the painstakingly crafted and researched book which we're talking about today that comes from the good folks at the Wisconsin Historical Society. I'm happy to have with me on the phone the co-authors of the book Studying Wisconsin, Martha Berglund, who used to teach English at Milwaukee Area Technical College and wrote on Mr. Lapham for Milwaukee Magazine, and that project, I assume, led rather seamlessly into further research and this book, which stands beside two different novels that she has written as well, A Farm Under a Lake and Idle Curiosity. Her co-author for many years, a science reporter at the Milwaukee Journal, is Paul G. Hayes, who, of course, in that line of work came to know much about Increase Lapham and his fascinating work, and helped lead to this collaboration. Once again, the book is Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham. And Martha Berglund and Paul G. Hayes, we welcome you both to the Morning Show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's good to talk with you, and it's been really great for me to learn something about this fascinating man. What would either of you want to add to what I've already said about his importance, and maybe a word as well about his relative obscurity, the fact that even though he was an important and fascinating man, there are a lot of us out here who don't know his name.
Well, it was interesting that he wasn't obscure during his lifetime and sort of immediately afterwards. He was probably one of the most famous men in Wisconsin at the time of his death. But over the years, he sort of has fallen out of our knowledge, even though he was, he did amazing things as an engineer and surveyor, a land agent for Byron Kilbourne. He was a map maker. As you said, he was a botanist and geologist. He was a meteorologist and sent the very first weather storm warning ever sent. And he was an archaeologist who mapped the Indian mounds of Wisconsin.
So it's a wide-ranging career, and it's interesting that we know so much about him. Explain how and why we can know so much about him, and indeed, through much of his childhood and young adulthood, it's as though we can nearly trace his every move, at least at certain points in time. Tell us about the sort of written legacy that he left behind him, which you could turn to in helping us really explore his life and career in such detail.
As a boy, he began keeping journals, which is a surprising habit for the time and for the place he was in, which was very near the frontier. He kept journals all of his life, and later, as he developed expertise in the various sciences, he maintained a profuse correspondence with the established scientists on the East Coast and in universities, and even in Europe. He kept every scrap of paper. He made lists. He wrote articles and books. He kept every scrap of paper he ever wrote on, apparently, to the extent that the Wisconsin Historical Society has 27 cartons of folders of Lapham material, including his published writings. Later on, his daughter, after Lapham's death, his daughter Julia, took all of his correspondence and journals and transcribed them in a typescript, which is, Martha, you have...
It's about 1,500 legal-sized, not quite double-spaced pages, so it's an amazing typescript that includes excerpts from all different kinds of his writings.
Mm-hmm. So we have all of that, and in fact, we think that the sheer abundance of material and the sheer diversity of his interests are so daunting that may be part of the explanation that this man has not had a full biography published about him since his death. So, but there's just a massive amount of material, and probably our biggest challenge was to condense it into a book that could be held in one hand.
Well, it makes for fascinating reading, and of course, it ends up taking us back into daily life in the early 19th century in a very, very vivid way. Explain a bit about Increase Lapham's background, that is, the Quaker family in which he grew up and the life which they enjoyed together.
Increase was the son of Rachel and Seneca Lapham, who were very devout Quakers. The father, Seneca, became a canal engineer. He was at first a carpenter, or not a canal engineer, but a canal contractor, and he worked in wood and stone on the locks of the Erie Canal. And it's really, his background is in a big Quaker family, though they lost many small children early on. And there were extended cousins, so, you know, he knew a lot of people all over the place. But really his background is on the canals. It was the canals that sort of brought him up. His work, he began to work when he was 12 or 13, just shaping stones on the Erie Canal at Lockport, New York, and it was the canals and the men who worked on them who were educated men, but also many of them Quakers and many of them interested in the natural world. Most of them, it was his very loving family and his very wide ranging acquaintances on the canals are really what brought him up more than schooling, which, as you mentioned, he had very little of.
You mentioned
the mantra, mm-hmm. the mantra of the family that was passed down to Increase from the very beginning was, do not idle away your time. Do something useful. Do something publicly useful, or do something useful for the family, and do it all of the time. And don't spend time introspectively worrying about yourself or what you might be doing if you really had freedom. So it was duty. It was public duty.
Absolutely.
that Increase not only was taught but went on to teach his own children all of his life. And there's not an idle moment in his 64 years of living. The amount of production he turned out is astonishing.
You tell us at one point that that his mother was his first teacher and an important teacher for him, and that and in describing the devoted work which she did in trying to help educate him, especially at those points in time when there wasn't the money for school, you write, "To the Quaker Laphams, curiosity was a virtue and education a necessity." And yet, as we've already touched on, in terms of formal schooling, Increase Lapham had relatively little of that. He ended up turning to all kinds of other tools and resources to satisfy his immense curiosity, including some of the most important publications of the day. Tell us what these publications were like and how significant they were for this young man growing up.
Well, he and his brother collaborated in a paper on the erratic boulders they found on the Ohio River, north of the Ohio River, and they sent it to Silliman's Journal of Science. Benjamin Silliman was the editor, and it was the last word in scientific endeavor in the 19th century for Americans. Silliman got this manuscript and published it, unaware that the authors were young men. Am I right on that? Is this the paper?
The first paper was the profile of the Ohio at Shippingport, Ohio. And that was when he was 16.
That's right.
And then the next year was the paper, I think it was the next year, on the erratic boulders in Ohio. And one of the interesting things is that Increase wrote it an extensive article, and Silliman's Journal had lots of little tiny pieces that were written by amateur naturalists, people who were farmers and just interested people. And then there were pieces in Silliman's Journal that were by major scientists, and these were the longer articles in the front of the magazine, in front of the journal. And Increase, his ambition from early on was to do one of the major articles, and he did at the age of 16.
Silliman didn't know he was 16, thought
yeah.
he was dealing with an adult. So he asked for more articles, and Increase, and this began a lifelong correspondence and relationship that continued right to Lapham's death.
Hmm.
And Silliman's Journal was an education in itself. If he was reading, and he was, every issue of Silliman's Journal, then he was learning about science all over the world, because Silliman imported, you know, the science writing from Europe as well. So he was able, even on the frontier in Milwaukee, to keep up with the science of the rest of the world.
Hmm. You mentioned that when he scraped together the money to first subscribe to the American Journal of Science and Arts, this subscription, him plunking down the money for this subscription, was, in your words, Increase Lapham's first independent step to educate himself. And you tell us that this journal, edited by Mr. Silliman, the list of subjects is a great range, a mishmash of science of the day, a a clearinghouse, a low-speed web page and blog of scientific thought ranging from particles of the effect of a stroke of lightning to a clearly written piece by Professor Dewey, added to by Silliman, on the uses of good meteorological data, how to be consistent in collecting such data, and what instruments to use. I suppose if we would read something like that now, we might react to it with kind of mixed feelings. I mean, in the sense that some of this was either crude science or perhaps not even science at all, but much of it clearly the work of earnest scientists and would-be scientists really wanting to better understand the world. And we can understand how this young man, Increase Lapham, would be really entranced by that.
Well, you know, even reading it today, Silliman's journal is pretty entertaining and pretty interesting. The writing was good. The editing was good. It was, there are still articles that, I mean, it was not dry science. It was interesting stuff, and it was interesting then, and it's still interesting today, even though, of course, most of it is outdated, but it was a good magazine, a good journal.
I think we need to realize that really, the early part of the 19th century and the latter part of the 18th century, that's the beginning of scientific discipline in a widespread way. Geology had maybe a 70-year history before Lapham became interested in it. Biology was unfolding even as he was growing up. So these are infant sciences. The world was explained not in scientific journals before this, but in churches. And this new attitude was just unfolding, and Increase was in on the beginning of it.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Paul G. Hayes and Martha Berglund about the book they have co-written for the Wisconsin Historical Society. The book is titled Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham, Early Chronicler of Plants, Rocks, Rivers, Mounds, and All Things Wisconsin. You tell us all about and even show us a few pages from the first significant journal kept by Increase Lapham himself, a journal which he titled rather humorously, Journal of Science and Arts with Miscellaneous Nonsense by the Author, a journal which he began in 1827, so still a young teenager. How much of this early journal survives, and how much of it were you able to actually examine?
The whole journal survives. It's this beautiful little book that you can, it's about the size of the palm of your hand. And it and several other, three or four other early journals still exist at the Wisconsin Historical Society Archive. And we were able to hold those in our hands and look at them and also read. And there's been a trend of publication of the, particularly the Ohio parts, of the Kentucky and Ohio parts of the journal, in a book by Thomas Clark and, God, I can't remember the other guy's name. But we were able, these books still exist. Increase was very adamant about saving, as Paul said, every scrap of paper. And so they're still there, and they're in Julia, the daughter's transcript as well, and they're just wonderful to read. They're just wonderful to look at, and some of it's very funny. I mean, he was a boy and he was silly, but he was also really not silly too. So there's really interesting stuff in there about 1827 and shipping port. Kentucky and the life of working on a boy working on a canal. So these books still exist, and they're well cared for by the Historical Society Archive.
It's amazing to me because, you know, when we think about something like this that's 100 and 185 years old or whatever it is. I'm doing the math very roughly, but I mean, that's a long time for something to
increase. Is 203 years old. So
yeah, and what's so intriguing to me is the fact that he moved around a bit, particularly at this point in time and in the years thereafter before he finally settled in Milwaukee. But to think that this little journal went with him again and again and again, and that even in that time and place, he was able to save this so it could be preserved to this very day. It's extraordinary.
He even survived a shipwreck on a steamboat on the Ohio River.
Yeah.
Luckily, it didn't get dunked. Only his rocks got wet. So
we think that when he stepped ashore in Milwaukee in 1836, we think that probably the biggest piece of luggage he had was a box of books, and they might have been the first books in Milwaukee. He stepped ashore at a place that had maybe 50 crudely thrown-up wooden houses and just as many wigwams in the Menominee River Valley of the Potawatomis who were still harvesting wild rice. So he was... This was the first time he was on the genuine American frontier, and he stayed here until his death in 1875.
Hmm. When he was yet a young man, I mean, for instance, that at the time that he was just writing this first important journal and so on, he was not only writing, bad spelling and all, as you tell us, but also a voracious reader. You tell us at one point, increase... politely ransacked the libraries of the men he knew in Louisville and Shippingport, and tell us at another point, he read to learn how to think. Tell us what he was busy reading, even as a young man, and the way in which this was such a crucial factor in the kind of intellect that he ultimately developed.
In one of his journals, he lists the major areas of science and his major interests and lists the authority in each area and the book written by that authority. And he made sure he had access to those authorities. I mean, these were the field guides, and more than that, the very important scientific writings of the time. So that not only did he know who had written the books, but he owned many of them. And actually, the first journal entry in his first journal is about his going to buy, I think one of the main things was Morse's geography, which Paul can talk more about.
Jedediah Morse is known as the United States' first geographer. In 1789, he published a geography of the United States, and Increase had it. And not only that, he had Jedediah Morse's gazetteer of the United States. That's just an alphabetical list of facts of places and events and geology. So he had these were foundation blocks, and in fact we think that his own book about Wisconsin generally follows the pattern for Wisconsin of Jedediah Morse's geography in the way he set it out. The Wisconsin book, which he started in 1838 as a gazetteer, but it turned out to be a geography. The Wisconsin book was started in 1838. In 1844, it became the first published book in Milwaukee. It told of its geology, of its archaeology, of its weather, of its botany.
The soils.
He dumped everything into it, and the intention was to send it eastward and bring immigrants to this wonderful place that he was falling in love with.
And it worked.
Yeah, it worked. And he had a second edition, And then it was pirated in Buffalo, New York, and so there was a third edition that just lifted huge amounts of material from Lappin's book and was published over somebody else's authorship. But it did work, and we in the Wisconsin Historical Society archives. You can pick up the handwritten manuscript of the first book published in Wisconsin. It's 6 inches deep and about 9 inches wide. It's about 4 inches thick, and it's sewn together by hand somewhere in Milwaukee by Lapham himself.
Wow. That would be worth seeing.
There's so much there that's worth seeing. It's an amazing archive. It's an amazing collection.
Wow.
But Lapham learned from his reading and learned from discussion of reading. He and his brother Darius corresponded. They frequently did not live in the same place. They most often didn't after they were teenagers, or while they were teenagers. And they wrote letters to each other. And for the purpose of discussion of the books that they read, and Increase especially kind of wanted to keep Darius to a kind of intellectual purpose in their letters. So he was very self-consciously teaching himself and discussing what he read with Darius, and they would send books back and forth too, because you know the books were expensive and they didn't have much money. So he not only read the books, but he examined them and was critical. And he and Darius together in their discussions came to the discussion deepened their knowledge of the material they read.
Hmm. As I read about some of this early writing of Increase Lapham, one of the things that was most interesting to me, and I think you do a wonderful job of helping us understand this, is how his intellectual life, as he would read these books and sit down and write in his journals and so on, was, at least in some respects, a retreat from part of what he experienced in those days when he was working on these canals. You write at one point, it may be part of Increase's drive to make order out of the natural world through knowledge of science and engineering arose from a concentration against the disorder and danger he saw in the lives of the ordinary men he saw every day knee-deep in the muck of the canal. His journals were his world of the intellect. His journals were workbooks. His journals were a refuge. Can you just say a word about what he would have been, in a sense, retreating from? What was life like for these men who worked on these canals? I think it really helps us even more vividly appreciate who Increase Lapham was and what was most important to him.
Well, in some places on the canals, particularly when they were digging through rock, like in Lockport, there was blasting going on all the time. And men they wouldn't just clear the area for these blasts. The men would just pretty much stand where they were and put their shovels over their heads so that, you know, for a little bit of protection. But men were killed by blasts on the Erie Canal. And in other canals, particularly and further to the south in Kentucky and Ohio, I mean, there were, you know, this was standing water in many cases, and there were mosquito-borne diseases like malaria and perhaps yellow fever. But men died a lot of diseases, and they lived in filthy conditions, just in camps at the side of the canal, and they weren't paid very well, and they were Irish immigrants. There were many of them in the South. They were slaves. These people really had a horrible life, and I think, generally speaking, a fairly short one. But Increase was a sort of social class above that, because he lived among the engineers and the contractors and the managers of the canal. So he did surveying and got down in the muck, but he was frequently somewhat above it, not only physically but mentally and emotionally as well.
Let me read a couple of paragraphs of Increase the writer when he's in Milwaukee. You're right. He takes refuge from a really boiling, turbulent place, and the helpmate in this refuge is in Milwaukee is his wife Anne. They had a wonderful marriage, and she made sure that he had quiet time. So here's a couple of paragraphs when he's writing the book on Wisconsin. In his spare time, especially in winter, when short days and inclement Wisconsin weather limited field work, Lapham pieced together his book on Wisconsin, sitting in flickering lamplight at his table, writing from notes and ink on longhand on precious paper, clipping newspapers from Green Bay, Milwaukee, and other places that he gathered during the week, and carefully tipping folded articles onto the pages of his growing manuscript. Outside, if a former Milwaukee newspaper man turned historian is to be believed, much of the rest of Milwaukee spent the dark, cold winter nights raising hell in hovels and on the streets. There were 138 rum holes in Milwaukee in December 1833, exclaimed James S. Buck in his 1881 Pioneer History of Milwaukee. So Increase is having none of this. He's inside writing.
A rum hole was a tavern.
Yeah, just a low-life place where rum was a euphemism for whatever they could distill overnight and serve the next day.
One thing, of course, that's also intriguing too is through this early period, much of the time he is working as a young teenager far away from his family and for the most part sending much of the money home to his family. He's helping his family survive. I mean, it's so important, I think, for us to understand what life was like and how, in a sense, there was a whole different sort of set of rules at play in this era, at least in a family like the Laphams.
Yeah,
that's what Paul was referring to earlier when he talked about the sense of duty. I mean, his sense of duty to his family was perhaps one of his strongest motivations.
We surmise that that's Quakerism and that it's been going on for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. That's the structure of that kind of family. Mm-hmm. So that we think that's the routine. And the expectation, and he certainly lived up to it.
Mm. Yes, more than lived up to it.
Yeah.
And also, I think that because they were separated so much, the family, after the time that Increase was about 15, he rarely lived with his family again. And they all the older boys went out and worked and sent money home to the family, that actually just two of them, besides Increase. It was the separation, in a way, that oddly made them close. They missed each other so much that they made very strong connections through letters and through this sense of duty and through investing together in a farm in Champaign County, Ohio, so that they had the feeling that there was this home, this center, this place they could all go to. And Increase himself hated moving around all the time. More than I think anybody in the family, he hated the fact that they could not put down roots, and this disconnection from his family actually made his feeling for connection to the family stronger, I think. I'm speculating.
You tell us that one interesting chapter just ahead of him moving to Wisconsin for the first time is when he goes to Columbus, Ohio, and has a job there in the state office building, and a second job or a second responsibility for which he's paid a little extra money. And it's a fascinating duty that he is given by the Ohio State Treasurer. It's just an interesting little sidelight, but tell our listeners about that.
Well, Increase gets a job. I mean, there were only really two buildings for the state of Ohio in Columbus at that time. And in one of them was the state treasurer's office. He worked next door in another one. And this one room, really, was literally the treasury and the treasurer's office. So the money for the state of Ohio was kept in this room, which had iron windows and iron doors, which would be bolted from inside. And Increase was hired to be the guy who bolted himself in every night with the money of the state of Ohio. And he was just to guard the state's money, which is just, I just think is sort of hysterically funny. But actually it wasn't funny, because there was a cholera epidemic at the time, and he was terrified that he would get cholera alone, you know, bolted into this room. And it was a possibility, but it didn't happen.
Hmm. Well, he survives that, and ultimately then moves to Milwaukee in the territory of Wisconsin in 1836. And I think you do a great job of describing what a wrenching move this was, and the fact that once he had accepted this position in far-off Milwaukee, it was a decision he regarded as rash, that he regretted and tried to extricate himself from, although ultimately unsuccessfully. Just help us understand what a drastic, dramatic, difficult move this was for the still young Increase Lapham to move to far-off Milwaukee.
Well, it was he had moved from behind the frontier, where some aspects of civilization had already taken deep root, to the very frontier itself. So he stepped ashore at a place that was largely unexplored, except for small settlements on the coast of Lake Michigan and in the mining district in the southwest. North of the Wisconsin River and the Fox Rivers, it hadn't even been surveyed. It was a wilderness, and so we can surmise that when Increase left Milwaukee for one of his many, many excursions, oftentimes he might have been his feet might have been the first to leave prints in many of the areas he walked on. And he was listening, he was watching, he was making notes, he was collecting. Days after he arrived in Milwaukee in 1836, he walked down to Racine, and probably on the lakefront, probably using the beaches as his sidewalk, and did exploring there. In Racine, over the years, he was joined by Philo Romaine Hoy, a medical doctor and also a naturalist, who was to become a lifelong colleague and friend. And they explored the effigy mounds in the Racine area together. They picked up rocks in the Racine on the Racine beaches and in from the bedrock. They and Philo Hoy became Wisconsin's chief expert on birds and ornithology, and he attributed that start to his friendship with Increase Lapham.
And when Increase was leaving Ohio for what he knew would be a fairly wild place, Milwaukee, he was leaving a lot of opportunities in opportunities that didn't pan out in Ohio. He could He had helped plan a state geological survey in Ohio and wanted to be in on that. He knew most of the naturalists in Ohio. His family all lived in Ohio. His work had been in Ohio. He really had, he was very closely connected with the state of Ohio. And Ohio was much more developed, of course, than Milwaukee was. So once he'd accepted this job in the Milwaukee, he began to think, what have I done? And think about what, all he was leaving. And he was right. It was just as Paul said. It was a wild place.
Right.
And Ohio was not. And so so there was he really didn't want to come here, which is a little hard for us to admit, I think.
You write, to increase it must have seemed that this offer of Kilbourne's would narrow his word and world and send him off to the edge of it besides. That is, this new wild place called Milwaukee, Wisconsin would be something like the edge of the world and far from civilization. And indeed, of course, in some ways it was. In fact, you tell us in the book that because Increase Lapham was drawn to Milwaukee because of this whole matter of the land frenzy and land speculation, at least to some extent, this led to a bit of a rupture between him and his beloved brother, Darius. Just what was he caught up in here?
Lapham began to be influenced by his boss, Byron Kilbourne, in land speculation, and he began to smell the temptation of getting rich quick. He bought some land on speculation in Menominee Falls, and he became Kilbourne's land agent. The whole reason Kilbourne was here was that his financial backer in Ohio was wanted Kilbourne to survey the western part of the western shore of Lake Michigan for prime settlement sites so they could build harbors and get in on the land boom. And they did that. And when Increase began writing about these matters to Darius, Darius clearly was offended by the land fever and by his brothers being drawn into it.
He thought he was being corrupted by his desire for money, and which really wasn't true. But Increase had written so many letters extolling the virtues and the opportunities in Milwaukee that Darius was just kind of sick of it, and sort of turned away from Increase for a short time in their lives, which is kind of sad.
And yet you tell us Increase, in the middle of these dark times, refused to give up on Milwaukee. Tell us what ultimately drew him to be kind of a permanent part of this part of the country. What was it that made the connection unbreakable?
I think the strongest connection was his wife, Anne, and her family connections here. But more than that was Increase's absolute desire to connect himself to a place and get to know that place and to not move around anymore. He really didn't want to uproot himself, and he knew what it felt like to, you know, to get to know a set of people or not get to know a set of people in a town like Portsmouth, Ohio, and then move to Columbus and then have to leave those people as well and all those connections, and to have done all that work for that place and then to leave it. So his connection with Milwaukee was, first of all, intentional. He had decided, I think, even though he didn't want to go, by the time he got to Milwaukee and by the time he saw the place, he decided this is where he would make his home. And then when he met his wife, Anne, which was not long after that, it was in 1838, then he was there forever.
But then he also recognized in Wisconsin and its wonderful botanical and biological and geological diversity, he recognized a blank slate of knowledge that he could become expert at. And his correspondents in the East, if they wanted to know about a Wisconsin plant or the geology of Wisconsin or virtually anything about Wisconsin, they had to deal with Increase Lapham, and he became the resident expert, the person who knew more about Wisconsin than any living person. And his legacy, that's one of his big—
Absolutely.
That's his legacy. He recognized what a grand place to study this was, and he became Wisconsin's leading expert. And he worked at that all of his life. That was what— even when he was in his worst financial shape, this is what drove him. And on the last day of his life, he was writing a paper about the about Oconomowoc Lake and its capacity for fish production. And then and he finished that paper, and within hours he was dead.
Hmm. And of course, he was such a generous man, intellectually, financially, and in every sort of way, which of course only deepened the value of what he did and explored. And of course, your book also gives us more examples of the extensive writing that he did. We can read excerpts and in certain cases even see facsimiles that show us exactly what these writings looked like and the important difference which they made in helping shape this corner of the country. The book again is called Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham, Early Chronicler of Plants, Rocks, Rivers, Mounds, and All Things Wisconsin, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, a beautiful and fascinating book, and its co-authors Martha Berglund and Paul G. Hayes. Well, we've just scratched the surface of a really fascinating story, but I'm so glad we got to talk today on the morning show about your wonderful book and about this fascinating man. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, my conversation with best-selling author Earl Swift about his book, The Big Roads, the untold story of the engineers, visionaries, and trailblazers who created the American superhighways. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You easily find The Morning Show archive right on the front page of WGTD's website, wgtd.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. From WGTD's community calendar, a reminder of the Metropolitan Opera's next high-definition simulcast this Saturday at 12 noon, Giacomo Puccini's final opera, Turandot. 12 noon at Tinseltown in Kenosha, the Renaissance in Racine, and movie theaters across the world. You can go to metopera.org for more information. Today will be cloudy and mild with a 40% chance of light rain or snow showers this afternoon. We're warming to a high of 39 degrees. Overnight, though, cold with cloudy skies, a low of 16 degrees. Tomorrow's high under partly sunny skies, 33 degrees. It's Saturday that we're promised a high temperature of 42. Sunday, a high of 46. Not quite as warm early next week. And there is the chance of some big snow coming our way around Tuesday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.